I'd like you to turn with me, please, to Leviticus chapter 6. I would especially like to thank the brethren for inviting me to speak. It's not always the case, but sometimes it is that when you get given a subject, you find it has an immense lasting effect upon you when you study it yourself. Now, sometimes you're given some subjects and you cringe nearly. And this was one that I'm doing today, the law of the offerings, which I must confess I had not looked at in a great amount of detail before. I studied the offerings, but not really the laws of the offerings, and what we'll find in chapter 6 and 7 of Leviticus. And so I wondered particularly how I would go about it, but it has had a real impression on me. So I thank the brethren, therefore, on a personal level, for giving me this subject for the benefit that it has been to me. You might wonder what benefit or what are we going to gain from studying the laws of the offerings. Now, I want to point that out at the beginning. And I want to do so just by starting to read a couple of verses from chapter 6, verse 8. Chapter 6, verse 8, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Command Aaron and his sons, saying, This is the law of the burnt offering." And then you'll find this kind of thing repeated. Look at verse 14. "This is the law of the meat or the meal offering." Come down to verse 24 of chapter 6. "The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto Aaron and to his sons, saying, This is the law of the sin offering." Verse 1 of chapter 7. "Likewise, this is the law of the trespass offering." And then come down to verse 11. "And this is the law of the sacrifice of peace offerings." And then if you come right down to the end of chapter 7 and verse 37, "This is the law of the burnt offering, of the meal offering, and of the sin offering, and of the trespass offering, of the consecrations, and of the sacrifice of the peace offerings, which the Lord commanded Moses in Mount Sinai in the day that he commanded the children of Israel to offer their oblations unto the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai." Now, the first thing that is different about these laws than what you would have come across so far is that they addressed specifically to the priests. Beforehand, in chapters 1 to 5, when you've been looking at the different offerings, of course, they were, in a sense, for the offerer, so that he knew what he had to bring and what he had to do, and the regulations around the offerings that he was to bring. It was really addressed to all of the nations. But when it comes to these laws in particular, they are addressed to the priests, the men that had to officiate in the giving of these offerings. Now just stop for a minute to think about how important these offerings were, or these laws of the offerings were. It was God, and again, it's very easy to lose a sense of the wonder of this, that there they were at Mount Sinai, and the transcendent Lord, the creator of heaven and earth, had come down. And he'd come down to speak to them, and he'd come down to invite them to draw near to him, to come to know the living God, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, to actually dwell with them so that they might have a relationship with him. The way that he did that, of course, was to give the instructions for the tabernacle and for its construction, and then to give these instructions with regards to offerings, that people could actually come and bring something to approach God and draw near to him. To do for what purpose? Well, in a sense, to come to see the glory of God, to behold the beauty of holiness. It stood unique. They might have seen the beauty of creation. They could have seen God's handiwork. Maybe at times where they stood on mountaintops and viewed the vista and everything else like that. But in a particular special way, this tabernacle, they were going to see a beauty that they had never seen before in this world. They were going to see the beauty of holiness, to see God's character, to come to know the living God. Well, these laws then would play a really important part. If nothing else, if the most obvious lesson to learn is this, is that God took particular care about how these offerings were to be offered. It mattered to him. It mattered who offered them. It mattered who ate them. It mattered what they brought. It mattered about the fire. It mattered about their clothes. It mattered about in exactly what order they had to do things. All of the finest detail around these offerings were legislated by God. God took particular care. It couldn't just be done haphazardly. I think that's the obvious application. It was a God of order who was setting in view particular regulations around how the offerings were to be made. So he was giving these to the priests, to the sons of Aaron. Now, you and I, of course, are priests, aren't we? We'll see that in a minute. But so the application then is we're going to be able to draw something. We'll see a parallel. Here they were. They were priests officiating on behalf of God. They had a service to do. It mattered to God how they did it. You and I are priests. We'll think for a moment, in a moment, about the sphere of our service. But the obvious thing to draw is this: how we do it matters to God. We're not left to do it in a slipshod, haphazard manner. It matters to him. But what was the danger? You know, fast forward 40 years from Mount Sinai, fast forward 80 years, 120. What was the great danger in all of this? And I would suggest that the further they got from Mount Sinai, this danger grew. And that was to lose a sense of the sacred. What I mean by sacred or holy, the holiness of God, the holiness, and we're going to see that as we study these laws, there's going to be a lot of reference to the holy. What was holy? Sometimes trying to understand that word, you have to look at the opposite of it. Now, it can have two different senses. Sometimes it's used in the sense of clean or unclean. So there'll be certain regulations about things that were clean and had to be clean, and they couldn't come in contact with anything that was unclean. That's one sense of the word holiness. But let's just imagine for a moment that, by way of illustration, suppose there was a lady, Mrs. Jones, and here she is, and she's cleaning her pots, and she's at home cleaning them, and she gets them spotlessly clean. They had to be clean, and been cooking, and she got them clean. But then just somebody, we've run out of pans down at the tabernacle. We could do with one of your pots, your frying pan, or whatever. Well, okay. It was taken in, and it was maybe used now in the service of God. But once it came in contact with something that was holy, it now became holy. It couldn't be used again by Mrs. Jones or Brown or whoever I said it. It was sacred. It was involved now in the sacred service of God. In that sense of holiness, it wasn't common anymore. That's what I mean by sacred. It couldn't be just a common. So there's going to be this sense of the danger, the great danger that I think that they had in the service of God was to lose the sense of the sacred. And this is where it's challenged me. It's very easy for the things of God to become common. Lose the sense of the sacred. Lose the sense of everything. We're going to find this. Some of their garments, flooded by blood. The priests were officiating. They couldn't just take those garments home. and wash them at home. You say, why not? Well, they've been splattered by blood that was to do with a sacrifice that God, that was holy. Now it's with a sacrifice sacred. And the place where they ate it, they couldn't just eat it wherever, that they had to eat it in a holy place, sacred place. Everything about their service was designed to remind them of the holy, the sacred. Everything about it. And there was a really important reason for that. Imagine here's somebody and they've sinned against God and they want to bring a sin offering. Suppose they arrived at the tabernacle and they look, where are the priests? Oh, it's their day off today, you know, and there's no flame on the altar. There's nobody around and the thing's half falling down. And what would they make of the series? They had come with a sense of the guilt of their sin. They had come to meet God and to bring a sacrifice. And if the priests had just turned the thing into something ordinary and common, the person that brought might have just had that same sense in their mind, this is just ordinary. Of course, that was what happened in the nation's history, wasn't it? It lost its sense of the sacred. They just turned it into, even when the Lord was here, wasn't it? The Father's house, it had just been turned into the common market, selling the animals and so on. It had lost the sense of the sacred. So I want to then, just for a couple of minutes before, to try to get into our minds, if we are priests, how might this apply to us in a broader sphere? And I want you to turn to 1 Peter in chapter 2. If I said to you, how big is your sphere of priesthood? Like, when does it operate? When are you functioning as a priest? In what capacity? Where? I wonder what you would say. I think you would probably say, like, right now, or an hour or so ago when you were meeting to remember the Lord, or when somebody's taking the Sunday school class, or maybe at the gospel meeting or the prayer meeting, we would certainly include that. I wonder what Peter would think. Now, he has a great sense of this, I take it, in his letter, the sense of the holiness of God. You remember in chapter 1, he commands them, be ye holy, for I am holy. He repeats the words of God, be ye holy, be ye set apart, be sacred. Now, what does that involve when it comes to priesthood? Look at chapter 2 and verse 5. Ye also, as living stones, are built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. Now, there's one aspect of priesthood that we would probably readily come to mind. This sense in which we have a duty to offer sacrifices to God, Godward. But that's not all that priesthood is. And we often maybe mistake the concept that it's just about worship to God. But that wasn't the entire function of the priests in the nation of Israel, was it? What else did they do? Well, they had to teach the people. That was one of their duties. It wasn't just officiating Godward. They had a duty, manward. They had a duty to explain to the people what they could bring. Here's a fellow from Galilee by the name of Zedekiah. And he decides he wants to bring an offering to God. And he doesn't know very much about the laws. It's been a while since he's read them. He's forgotten all about them. And he says, I've got a lovely pig. I'm going to wash it up, and I'm going to take it up to the temple, and I'm going to offer it. Well, as he gets there, it's a good thing. He meets a priest. The priest says, that's a fine attitude you have, but that's not acceptable to God. But he would have to teach him what God is looking for. What are God's standards? What are God's regulations? And that one of the roles of the priest was to teach the people the law of God, to put within the sense of what was acceptable to God. They had a role that was manward. Mind you, so too does the Lord Jesus, as our great high priest, just by way of diversion for a second. In his ministry as our great high priest, it isn't just interceding It is this sense in which he puts within our hearts a sense of what God demands from us and what God is looking for and what would be pleasing to God. And he teaches us what is acceptable to God. So it's that dual sense. I want you to see what Peter says here in chapter 2. Look at what he says in verse 9. But ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should show forth the praises, the excellences of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. You're a holy priesthood. But I would suggest that here the emphasis is not so much on declaring it to God, but declaring it to the world. We have a role as priests on behalf of God to show forth, to declare to the world the excellencies of the God whom we represent. Well, you say, how do I do that? Well, I don't have time, but if you read the rest of chapter 2, do you know what he says? He says, you do it when you're obeying the laws of the land. You do it when you're obeying your master at work. Wives, you do it at home, even when your husband isn't saved. Husbands, you do it for the glory of God in your house. That's where you show forth the excellencies of the God who called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. In each of those little things, as you go through 2 Peter and chapter 2 and chapter 3, what you'll find is this. He brings before them in each of those spheres that they do it as unto the Lord, or they do it before the Lord. They do it with a sense of the sacredness of the space in which they're moving. Now, this is exactly the same thing as when we're going to come back to Leviticus chapter 6 and 7. There's going to be this repeated phrase that when they're doing the offering, they were to remember that they did it before the Lord. When those priests, you see, there was a danger, wasn't there? Imagine a priest. Imagine you're a priest for a moment. There's a great danger that after the first time you offered a sacrifice, I think your knees would have been knocking and you would have had an incredible sense of the sacredness of the office that you were fulfilling. But after day 1,345 and after you've offered thousands and thousands of sacrifices, it would be really easy, wouldn't it, to forget that you were doing it as unto the Lord, that you were doing it before the Lord. It could just become common. Many of us have had to get up for work on thousands and thousands and thousands of occasions. It's really easy to forget that we're priests going into a workplace. We serve the Lord. We do it as unto the Lord. When we obey the authorities of the land, we do it as unto the Lord. When we serve our masters at work, we do it as unto the Lord. We leave the confines of our home. We get up in the morning. If we were to go with a sense of the sacred, that we were serving the Lord when we went to work, when we went to the office, when I went about my daily affairs as a father or as a mother, it's so easy to lose the sense of the sacred. That is priestly function. As far as I can't see how it doesn't touch every aspect of our life. If it's in this sense in which we're showing, declaring the excellencies of the God who called us out of darkness and into his marvelous light. So with that then, I want you to come back and I want you to we're just going to pick up fairly briefly some of the things that are emphasized. It's not everything. Everything is not repeated in these laws. It seems that perhaps there was just a few things from each of them that God wanted to ensure that the priests didn't forget. And they were maybe the things that there was a danger of them forgetting. The danger of them forgetting that it was important, that they could lose this sense of what was sacred. So let's offering in chapter 6 and verse 8. Now, it's actually fairly obvious in most of them because it's usually emphasized. So let's read together the burnt offering, and you'll soon see what the emphasis is here, the danger, the thing that God wanted to ensure that they didn't forget. Verse 8 of chapter 6, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Command Aaron and his sons, saying, This is the law of the burnt offering. It is the burnt offering because of the burning upon the altar all night unto the morning, and the fire of the altar shall be burning in it. And the priest shall put on his linen garment, and his linen breeches shall he put upon his flesh, and take up the ashes which the fire hath consumed with the burnt offering on the altar, and he shall put them beside the altar. And he shall put off his garments and carry forth the ashes without the camp unto a clean place, and the fire upon the altar shall be burning in it. It shall not be put out. The priest shall burn wood on it every morning and lay the burnt offering in order upon it, and he shall burn thereon the fat of the peace offerings, and the fire shall ever be burning upon the altar. It shall never go out." I don't think it's very hard to work out this law is. It was to ensure that the fire never went out. The danger, again, would be that if in their officiating of this altar, they didn't take their job very seriously and somebody clocked off early and went home and the fire went out. Imagine then that somebody has come to offer his burnt offering the next morning. And he comes, and a man comes because, why would he come, by the way, with a burnt offering? We say it had nothing to do with sin. Well, I'm not so sure about that, because it does say it was for him, doesn't it, in chapter 1. Now, I'm not considered on this, but I'll just that he may have had his shortcomings. In what sense? What was the very first law? Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and soul and strength. Maybe as he was reminded again of that law, he would think, my devotion to God has fallen short. Maybe not a specific sin, but just maybe even that very first commandment. I'm not wholly devoted to the Lord like I ought to be. And so he comes. He comes with a sense of wanting to bring an offering to God, to express perhaps the desire within his heart that he would long that he was entirely devoted to the Lord. And he arrives. And there's no fire. And there's no men there. And the whole thing's sort of just a little bit of smoke coming from the ashes. Doesn't speak very well, does it, of the kind of devotion that God was looking for from the heart of the nation of Israel. For a wholehearted, constant devotion from them. That's why this fire had to burn night and day. When anybody approached the altar, the very first thing they would see would be this burnt and even a sense there of the presence of God. A sense of the type of devotion that God was looking for. It should never, ever go out. It's easy to go out, isn't it? You ever felt times when the fire has gone out? Searching, isn't it? Come before God, and if it's never touched you, well, it's certainly touched the person in front of you. Fire's gone out. Well, they were given commandments about what to do to make sure. One was this: they had to get all the ashes. Get rid of all of the ashes from the sacrifice from the day before. Now, one thing to note about this, those ashes weren't bad. In fact, ashes are good in a sense, isn't it? What does it show you? If you've got beautiful white ashes, well, there was a fantastic night before, and it really burnt well. And the ashes are just the evidence of an amazing fire. But you couldn't just poke those ashes again and try to get the fire going. If you do that, you might get a couple of little embers start, but it'll then quickly. What did they need to do? They needed to with those ashes. That was the evidence of an enjoyment of a sacrifice that had taken place and been consumed by the fire on the altar and accepted by God, maybe the night before. And he had to be very careful with what he did with the ashes. He had to take them out and put them into a clean place. Then he got rid of the ashes. And then he had to start a little fire. That's what you would do. Coming from Australia, a single fire until I came to this country and we got a wood burner. I tell you, there was a lot of smoke in the house until I finally got the knack of this. I think my wife nearly threatened to move out. Well, she's only nearly banned me from starting any fires. It took a while to realize I had to get rid of all the ashes. I just had to start with a little bit of wood, get the kindling going, get a fire. And then before I started to pile everything else on top of it, I had to make sure that was just carefully going again. And then I could put the new. It's not always easy to get a fire going again. We do have to be careful, don't we, with one another when the fire's gone out. It's not a matter of just getting some big billows and giving them a big old squeeze and trying to get it. You might have to get rid of the ashes. You see, there's a danger that we think we can start the fire again with the ashes from yesterday's sacrifice. Maybe when we were saved, we were in the full. The enjoyment of the forgiveness of sins. And then that joy seemed to just ebb a bit. We think, if only I could recover that old joy of the forgiveness of sins. If only I could get that back again. I would suggest to you, you know, you can't be saved all over again. God doesn't want you to try to recover the fire from the night before, the enjoyment of that. There's a better way. We take away the ashes. We put on something new, some new material. It begins to burn. Isn't that your experience? Maybe it just, the fire just ebbs a little. And there's a period in your life and you went through intense suffering. And you came to know something about, not just now that the Lord has forgiven my sins, but he was a shepherd. A shepherd who would draw near, comfort me. You say, I've learned something. I've learned more about him than I knew when I first got saved. And I've got new material on the fire now, and it's burning. Here's somebody else, and they go through experiences. They knew that God was the God of all comfort. But now they're experiencing it firsthand. They're getting new material on the fire. The role of the priest was to make sure that the fire never went out. It was his job to see that there was always new material put on the fire. Something we could do for one another, isn't it? We can all be there. We can all feel like that. But it takes some care just to get the fire going again. Just a word about the Lord, something you've enjoyed that might help somebody else. You might be able to visit somebody. You could leave something with them. It just gets the fire going. Again, you put new material on the altar. The next meal offering. So let's just come down to that. Verse 14, this is the law of the meal offering. The sons of Aaron shall offer it before the Lord, before the altar. And he shall take of it his handful of the flour of the meat offering and of the oil thereof and all the frankincense which is upon the meal offering and shall burn it upon the altar for a sweet savour, even the memorial of it unto the Lord. Now we'll pick up one or two things from here, and then we'll, for the sake of time, we'll have to move on to the next offering. In most of these offerings, there was always something where it was said that all of it had to go on. In the burnt offering, it was all of the animal, apart from the skin. In this one, the meal offering, it was all the frankincense. All of it. Now, why would that be important here? What was the danger for these priests with the meal offering? Well, imagine somebody had, and they could bake it at home, couldn't they? They could bring it. At this point, it probably just looked like any other ordinary meal. But it wasn't, was it? This was a gift. That was what the meal offering was. It was a gift to God. It was an expression from a person's heart who had maybe, they'd had a great harvest and they'd got some flour from it and they'd made it and they wanted to return to God a sense of this thankfulness that God had given them this harvest again. And you could just imagine it. Imagine them sitting there and thinking back. Grandparents were, they were slaves in Egypt, and here we are in the promised land. Amazing, isn't it? Every year God gives us another harvest. They bake a cake and they take it. The priest says, oh, this is just like the last cake I had. This is my wife bakes cakes like this. Put it on the altar. Make sure all of the frankincense, all of it, the most costly thing they had. They would say that frankincense, you know, it was worth its weight in gold, literally. That's how expensive it was in those days. And the priest saw to it that this was no ordinary meal. This was sacred. This was someone's expression of a gift they wanted to bring to the Lord, all of the frankincense. All of it had to be put on the offering. The danger was to treat it like an ordinary meal. Could that ever happen in these days? Happened in Corinth, didn't it? Paul had to address them in chapter 11 that they had turned the Lord's Supper into an ordinary meal. It had lost the sense of the sacred, just become an ordinary event. Well, down to the sin offering, verse 24. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak with Aaron and to his sons, saying, this is the law of the sin offering. In the place where the burnt offering is killed, shall the sin offering be killed before the Lord. It is most holy. Now we're looking again for a word that might keep popping up here. The priest that offereth it for sin shall eat it in the holy place. Shall it be eaten in the court of the tabernacle of the congregation? Whatsoever shall touch the flesh thereof shall be holy. When there is sprinkled of the blood thereof upon any garment, thou shalt wash that whereon it was sprinkled in the holy place. But the earthen vessel wherein it is sodden shall be broken, and it shall be scoured and rinsed in water. All the males among the priests shall eat thereof. It is most holy. And no sin offering whereof any of the blood is brought into the tabernacle of the congregation to reconcile with all in the holy place shall be eaten. It shall be burnt in the fire. I don't think, again, it's very difficult to see the emphasis in this law of the sin offering. The emphasis on what is holy. You might wonder, why would that be linked to the sin offering? Well, it is emphasizing this, that there was a danger that the seriousness of sin could be lost. You know, you could bring a sin offering and then another sin offering and another sin offering until you forgot that sin was serious. It, of course, is the very accusation, isn't it, that was raised against Paul's gospel, and that people could just go on sinning and get more forgiveness. So when it came to this sin offering, they had to be reminded of the holiness of God and what sin had actually done. How serious it was. Look how serious it was. He says, you couldn't just offer the sin offering anywhere. Where did you have to offer it? He says, in the very same place where you offered the burnt offering. How serious was our sin? What did it mean for the Lord to become a sin offering? Did it matter where he was sacrificed? Was it just in a haphazard place? Did it have any significance? Was it important? How would you measure it? How might it be linked to this place where the burnt offering was offered? Well, maybe in your mind, rewind a few hours from the cross and come back to a garden. And there see a man lay down his very will, his emotions, poured out before God of what it meant to be devoted to the Father. The true measure of what it meant for him to be that burnt offering. His total devoted life laid down, his will surrendered to the Father in the very place where the burnt offering was offered, the sin offering was offered. You want to measure what it meant for him to sin? Go back to the Garden of Gethsemane. Get a sense of the emotion. Get a sense of the very distress of his soul as he contemplates what it would be for him to be made sin for us. And then you'll notice some of the other things that they were to do. It says in verse 26, the priest that offereth in the holy place shall it be eaten in the court of the tabernacle of the congregation. He couldn't just go and eat it anywhere. You see, all of these regulations were just almost in a sense to keep reminding the priest what he was touching, what he was working with, what he was doing here was sacred. He couldn't just pop it in his pocket and take it home for later, eat it with the family and what, you know. He had to eat it in the holy place. He was touching something that was serious, that was solemn before God. This was a sin offering that this man had brought. Then he says, whatsoever shall touch the flesh thereof shall be holy. And when there is sprinkled of the blood thereof upon any garment, thou shalt wash that whereon it was sprinkled in the holy place. Let's think about it. He has a garment. And I would imagine it was pretty messy business being a priest. Very easy for the blood of that sin offering to have got splattered on its garments. Did it matter? I mean, it was only blood. Take it home and wash it, put it in the washing machine with all of his other clothes? No. See, even the very blood, just the sprinkling of that blood was serious. God wanted, you see what God is doing? He's trying to say everything about this sacrifice is sacred. Even the spot of blood that got on your garments, you've got to wash that here in a holy place. Your garments, you see, now the reason was for this. Those garments were sacred even. They'd come in contact with his offering. They couldn't just be his average clothes for the next day. Everything that had come in contact with that sacrifice was sacred. Belonged to the Lord. You ever come in contact with a sin offering? But if you have, you now belong to the Lord. See the point? Anything that came in contact with this sin offering now was sacred, belonged to the Lord, it was his. If the pot from Mrs. Jones came in contact with this sin offering, it was now the Lord's, it wasn't Mrs. Jones's anymore. Anything like that in the New Testament? You and I have been bought with a price. We're not our own. We belong to him. We've come in contact with something that was sacred. Now, I'll need to move on for the sake of time. But you could go right down through all the pots and you see everything there that is, if it's come in contact with the blood, if it couldn't be removed, then it had to be smashed. And if it could be completely scoured, then it could be used again. But you'll notice there is one thing, one additional requirement that's placed there in verse 30. No sin offering thereof, whereof any of the blood is brought into this tabernacle of the congregation to reconcile with all in the holy place shall be eaten, it shall be burnt in the fire. The one thing in particular that stands out in the sin offering is the blood, the price that was paid to have the man's conscience cleared of the guilt of his sin. And there's almost like a follow-on warning here. That blood is sacred. You cannot eat any of it. It was a sacred offering to the Lord. Now the trespass offering, in verse 1 of chapter 7, likewise, this is the law of the trespass offering. It is most holy. Now just, I forgot to mention this expression, most holy. Whenever you get that, most holy, it means that the offerer couldn't partake of it. And all of the things that were could only be eaten by the priest, or they had to be completely offered to the Lord. But when you get to the peace offering, it's not that, right? So this is different. So, but this trespass offering was most holy. Now look just at the thing that's mentioned here. In a sense, it's very similar to the sin offering, and maybe Josh mentioned this last week. When you get to the verse 7 of chapter 7, it says, as the sin offering is, so is the trespass offering. There is one law for them. Okay, so pretty much all thought about for the sin offering was true too for the trespass offering. And Josh probably mentioned this last week about one of the major distinctions of the sin offering. We can sometimes think of it, it's very easy for us to think of it all as one, but here they were divided into two. And if Josh said something different than me, I would go with what Josh says. So just ignore what I say. Only stick with anything that agrees with Josh. But my understanding of the trespass offering, the thing that really was pointed out was this: the damage that the person's sin had done. The damage. The damage not only to themselves, but the damage to the Lord. They did it against the Lord. They had to realize that. But secondly, the damage that it did to other people. Do you ever stop and think about that? The damage that our sin does. The damage that our words do. The damage of things that we do and what it portrays to other people. All of the damage that your sin and mine has done. Praise God, there was a sacrifice for that. Not just for the conscience, not just for the stain of sin that was left in my conscience. That's more the sin offering I would take. But here it is to make restoration for all the damage that my sin has done. What a cost. What a cost. Now, just on that, before I pass, I'm sure Josh probably mentioned that. If there was things that could be put right, that the person could put right, he had to do that. And then to bring a trespass offering. In other words, if he'd stolen something, he had to put that right and pay a bit extra as well. Or if he'd damaged somebody's property, he had to put that right and then to bring a trespass. It wasn't that the trespass offering just covered everything and it didn't matter. No, he had to put right what he could put right. And I would suggest that that's a lesson that we all need to learn. Zacchaeus was a great example of that, wasn't he? He put right what he could put right. But when they came to sacrifice, the obligation on the priest was this: make sure that all of the fat went on it. The very best part of all of the inwards of that animal, make sure all of the fat was on the altar. The man had been guilty of defrauding God, or defrauding his neighbor, or defrauding somebody else. When that fat was put on the altar, I would suggest the thought that would have been in their head was this: that was some cost to put that right. It is a marvelous thing that in the gospel, God has put right everything. He's put right even all of the things, one day, even all of the damage that our sin has caused, the things that maybe we can't even go back to restore, but all of the damage that our sin has done, the work of Christ will one day restore it all. Amazing, isn't it? I'll finish with this then, 1 or 2 minutes, the peace offering. What perhaps might be the danger that might be associated with the peace offering? I would suggest it's this. There was a danger that they could keep the peace offering without the enjoyment of the peace. Because that's what it was really designed to do, right? It was there so that they might enjoy fellowship with God and fellowship with one another. Right? This peace, this fellowship that it brought them into. It wasn't just Godward, it was towards their fellow man as well. But God ultimately wanted them to enjoy the thing. This is the great thing about these offerings. God wanted the offerer to enjoy part of all of these ceremonies. It wasn't just Godward, if I could put it that way. He wanted the person to be whole, to enjoy the thing. Well, look at where it begins. Verse 11 of chapter 7, and this is the law of the sacrifice of peace offerings, which he shall offer unto the Lord. If he offer it for a thanksgiving, then he shall offer the sacrifice of thanksgiving. Unleavened cake mingled with oil, and unleavened wafers anointed with oil. Cakes mingled with oil of fine flour fried. Besides the cakes, he shall offer his offering leavened bread with the sacrifice of thanksgiving of his peace offerings. It's interesting that this begins with the idea of thanksgiving. This is what if somebody could bring just out of thanksgiving to God for the peace that they were enjoying. He wanted them to enjoy it. But there were certain stipulations around what they were to bring with it, and one of them was this, that they were to bring both unleavened and leavened cakes. You say that's a strange thing. Now, the never meant to be, or was not offered in that sense of being a part of an atonement for sin. So what was the point then of having leavened and unleavened? Well, I would suggest perhaps even that the man himself, as he brought this as thanksgiving, might have felt that in all of it that he wanted to express, it fell short of really what he wanted to give. Even in his thanksgiving, even in his enjoyment, it just was still tainted with a sense that it wasn't really all that he could bring to God. I don't know, maybe that was the point. He had something leavened and something unleavened. Even he himself in that recognized that it wasn't perfect. But then as you go on, and I'll close with this, if he'd brought a bullock for a peace offering, or something big, of course, part of that peace offering was that God had his portion, and the priest got a portion, and the offerer, he got a portion. That was a lovely thing about that, wasn't it? He went home with him. A whole lot of meat. I'm not mentioning that because I'm hoping for a good lunch. But the point was that if there was a lot of meat and he couldn't eat it all there and then, he got to take it home. But he had to eat it the next day. Couldn't last the third day. Last the third day, you had to get rid of it. Well, you say it's a strange thing. You put it in the freezer. Well, I didn't have freezers back then, but you know. What was the point? Well, think of this big boiling now. I know there's some folk that like meat. Suppose you had to eat it all within 48 hours, the whole lot, the whole bullet. You couldn't, could you? You have to get your family and bring everybody, you know, get it, and then you'd have this lovely meal. But you had to be very careful. You had taken home something that had been offered to God. And there were very clear stipulations, even when you got to take that home. was not to forget it was sacred. The people that were allowed to eat it, not to get touched with anything that defiled in the home, not to, you know, but the whole thing, it still had to, it's still even in the home there. The man had taken it home. He could enjoy it with everybody around him, but he still had to have a sense that what he was eating was sacred. It had been offered to God. God had given it back to him. He had to be in the home. And I'll finish just by maybe taking that then. Is that not maybe what Peter was talking about in 2 Peter? That you take what was sacred and you go out into the home or into the workplace, but you still have to be careful that you're handling, you're taking something that is sacred. And oh, may God help us to maintain the sense of the sacred. That's what I learned from these laws. They really touched my heart. Showed up all my short fallings. Took me to my knees. All that God would restore, if nothing else, a sense of the sacred in our hearts. Shall we pray?